Mr. Secretary General. That was wonderful, and it's just so great to see everybody here. Thank you for the energy we're all feeling from the audience and from the Georgetown community. And I also wanted to, building on Bianca's excellent introduction, say a word of gratitude for your service. I think, you know, some people say that Angela Merkel became sort of the leader of the free world, but now that she's on the way out, your tenure as a major statesman in the West is really up there as the most longstanding and I think the most productive. And I really wanted to begin, if I could, with just a few questions before we go to the general audience. But I want to start with Russia because, of course, you began your service as Secretary General after having been Prime Minister of a NATO member country during a period when Russia was getting a little bit more problematic. And then in the early months of 2014, things got very tough. And there have been a lot of responses that you've helped orchestrate or coordinate since then by NATO, including more burden sharing, including putting battalions and brigades in Poland and the Baltic states, including the European Union and American and Norwegian sanctions on Russia. How do you feel about the state of European security vis-a-vis Russia in 2021? Do you think that after these 7 years of pushback, that we have at least partially stabilize the situation? I realize nobody in your position is going to want to say things are fine as long as Vladimir Putin's still sitting in the Kremlin, still trying to cause mayhem in some of the Western democracies. But do you feel that we've at least made some progress and that we're a little safer today vis-a-vis Russia than we were 7 years ago?
So yes, we have made a significant progress and we have adapted NATO not least to respond to a more aggressive Russia. And as I said, the really big adaptation of NATO started after the illegal annexation of Crimea. But at the same time, I think we have to realize that the relationship between NATO, the transatlantic family, and Russia is at the lowest point since the end of the Cold War. After the end of the Cold War, we actually thought that we were able to build a relationship with Russia to strengthen to build a partnership with Russia. And I remember I attended the NATO summits where actually President Putin was attending the same meetings. We established something called the NATO-Russia Council. We had step-by-step strengthen our cooperation and political dialogue with Russia. And many of us were quite optimistic. Then this gradually started to change, partly in 2008 when Russia went into Georgia and actually took control over part of Georgian territory. And then the big change came in 2014 with the illegal annexation of Crimea. And then after that, they have continued to destabilize eastern Ukraine. On top of that, we have seen a significant military buildup by Russia. They have deployed a new advanced weapon systems. They have violated one of the cornerstone of arms control, the INF agreement that banned all intermediate range weapon systems. And we have seen a more aggressive Russia abroad in many places and then a more repressive Russia at home, cracking down on the opposition, as we have seen, for instance, against Alexei Navalny. So this picture is serious. The good news is that NATO has responded in a very decisive and united way, as you just referred to. And we do so also knowing that we have what we call a dual-track approach to Russia. Deterrence defense and dialogue. It's not deterrence and defense or dialogue. When we are strong, when we are united, we can talk to Russia. And we have to talk to Russia because we don't want a new Cold War. We don't want a new arms race. And Russia is our neighbor, so we need to engage with them. And I can tell you, as you refer to that, I know that even during the coldest period of the Cold War, Norway, as a neighbor to Russia, was able to talk to Russia on issues like energy, a new delimitation line, environmental issues, and many other issues. And that was not despite NATO. It was because of NATO. Because NATO provided the strength for a small country as Norway to engage with a big neighbor as Russia. So we will continue to pursue this dual-track approach. We need to talk to them on many issues, including, for instance, on arms control. And there are many things that have gone in the wrong direction, but there is one thing is good, is a positive sign, and that is that Russia and the United States were able, just a few months ago, to extend the new START treaty banning, or not banning, but limiting the number of strategic weapons, warheads, and also engage in what they call to the strategic dialogue on arms control. So I don't know whether I answered your question, but at least I spoke about Russia. And the thing is that we need to just continue the dual-track approach to our neighbor Russia.
Could I follow up on that, too, by asking about the future of expansion or enlargement of the alliance, which for some of us who have been concerned about that, especially when Ukraine and Georgia are mentioned as potential candidates, it makes us worry that this is almost a guarantee to exacerbate relations with Russia. You can certainly understand why Ukraine and Georgia would want the opportunity. But is it time that NATO changes the whole dialogue and the whole thinking about what options? Maybe we need a new kind of security architecture for Eastern Europe that would not be formal membership in NATO, but also not leave these countries out in the cold with the Russian bear standing next door. Is there any kind of need, as you now think about your strategic concept, which will be in many ways the culmination of your tenure, and you think about some of the big ideas that should guide the alliance in the future, do we need some new big ideas on how to think about East European security architecture?
I think, first of all, it is important to establish some basic principles and values. And that is that it is the right for any sovereign nation to decide its own path. The whole idea that, you know, it's a provocation to Russia that small neighbors join NATO is absolutely wrong. That's the provocation, that anyone is saying that. Because it is enshrined in different documents, agreements, treaties, and not least the Helsinki Final Act, that every nation, of course, has the right to choose its own path. So it's up to the individual sovereign nation to decide whether they want to join NATO or they don't want to join NATO. It's for them to decide. So whether a country is going to become a member of NATO is for that aspirant country and for NATO allies to decide, no one else. And just this message that it is so provocative for Russia that Latvia and Lithuania and Estonia or Slovakia or Czechia have joined NATO, I mean, that just exemplifies that Russia wants a world order where they have a sphere of influence, where they have Russia and then they control their neighbors. And that's not the world I would like to live in. And actually, we have tried for decades to move away from that world. And to be honest, there are also some voices in the West would say, no, we should be careful because we are provoking Russia. But then you're saying that small countries don't have the right to choose their own path, which is like a violation of their sovereignty. And then sometimes I use my own country because we joined NATO, and Norway joined NATO in 1949 as a founding member. We are a small neighbor of Russia. And Russia didn't like that Norway joined. Actually, Josef Stalin expressed very clearly that he thought that we should stay out. But I'm happy that Clement Attlee, the Prime Minister of UK, and Truman, I guess it was the President in the United States, and all the other leaders, they said that Norway, they can join if they want. Josef Stalin is not going to decide whether NATO and Norway can be a NATO member. So we joined. We provoked Russia, maybe, but we are part of a very happy family. So that's my main message. And there are too many people who are a bit unclear on these fundamental principles, meaning indirectly accepting some kind of sphere of influence for big powers. That was then the other thing. And that is Georgia and Ukraine. Of course, it's only for NATO members and Georgia and Ukraine to decide when they're ready to join. Not Russia. No one else has a veto or a say in that. So we support their efforts to modernize, to reform, to meet the NATO standards. And when 30 allies agree that they are ready to join, they will join. I cannot tell you when that will happen, but that's the only way that this can be dealt with. Having said that, I think it's obvious that it will not happen tomorrow, that they will join. So therefore, my message to NATO allies, and also something I discussed actually yesterday with President Biden, is that we need to step up and do more for those aspirant countries. because as long as they're not members, we should provide more support, more training, more capacity building, help to implement reforms, fight corruption, build their security and defense institutions. So we need to establish that there is a lot in between nothing and full membership. That's what I'm pushing hard in within NATO, and I hope that we can make some ambitious decisions at the next NATO summit. But again, that doesn't change the sovereign right of every nation to choose its own path.
Extremely cogent and powerful message. I've just got really two more questions, and I want to share the privilege here with the audience pretty soon. But let me ask you about Afghanistan and also about China, if I could. You already referred to Afghanistan in your opening presentation, and a lot of us in the United States, a lot of Americans were happy with President Biden's decision in April, which really seemed like it was President Biden's decision, not NATO's decision, to leave. A lot of us were concerned, however, at how this has played out. Some of us were against it from the start, but leave that as it be. I realize you don't want to rehash that decision, but I wanted to invite you to speak about how NATO is going to recover from the withdrawal and the chaos of the summertime. And specifically, if I could ask this, you've been clear in saying that the men and women who served from all these NATO countries and other countries in Afghanistan should be proud of their service because they've kept us safe for 20 years, among other things, and they've given Afghans at least a vision of a better future, even though that's going to be challenged now, perhaps, by Taliban rule. It strikes me there's one more argument, and I wanted to ask for your comment on this, which is I think the Taliban may feel like they got a certain kind of victory against us, but they also are impressed by our combat capability. They've been fighting us for 20 years, and it's pretty clear to me watching them the last couple of months, they don't want to fight us again. They helped us do the evacuation. They gave us permission to control Kabul, even if it had already fallen to them. They didn't do a great job of security near the airport, but they actually tried to help. And they're going out of their way not to pick a fight, at least not a military fight, with NATO. It strikes me. I think we have created a certain form of deterrence, even in a losing effort or a strategic failure, as General Milley said last week. Do you agree with that? But more generally, how do you look back on the Afghanistan mission and the departure of this past summer?
I think you have to start with the beginning, and that is that after the 9/11 attacks on the United States, where close to 3,000 people were killed, it was obvious that there was a need to react. And we reacted strongly, of course the US, but also all NATO allies. NATO allies, together with partners, we have been in Afghanistan for 20 years, with the main task of preventing that country from once again becoming a safe haven for international terrorists, where they can organize, plan, train for terrorist attacks against our own countries. So we were in Afghanistan to protect ourselves. We invoked Article 5 to protect ourselves. And actually, we achieved that because over these 20 years, there have been no terrorist attack against our countries, organized, planned, executed from Afghanistan. Meaning also that the mission was not in vain, and those who have paid the ultimate price, those who have lost loved ones, family members, they should know that actually they made an important contribution, they made a difference in the fight against terrorism, and we have seen the devastating effects of that 9/11. And you also have to remember that all the efforts, not only in Afghanistan, but also sharing more intelligence, improving the way we counter terrorism, has actually meant that since 9/11, we've not seen anything of that magnitude before when it comes to terrorist attacks against our own countries. And that has not just happened by accident. It's a result of huge efforts by NATO allies and some partner countries. Then the plan was never to stay in Afghanistan forever. Therefore, we faced a very difficult dilemma when we started the discussions after the signing of the U.S.-Taliban agreement in February 2020 for the U.S. and others to leave and end the military presence there. And the dilemma was the following. Either to leave and then risk Taliban returning, and we were clear-eyed about that risk. The surprise is actually not that Taliban came back. The surprise was that it happened so quickly. Either to leave and risk Taliban returning, or stay, but that also entailed risks of more fighting, more violence, more casualties, and most likely also the need to send in more NATO troops. So there were no easy options in Afghanistan. And then it was actually, of course, the U.S. that made the decision on behalf of the United States, but they made that decision after extensive consultations with all NATO allies. I've seen some reports that there have been no consultations. That's factually wrong. We had three ministerial meetings. We had a number of committee meetings, North Atlantic Council meetings at the ambassador level at NATO, discussing whether to stay or leave Afghanistan also throughout the whole winter, and even before that. So the idea that we that the United States did not consult is wrong. We went in together, we adjusted our presence together, and we left Afghanistan together. The main task now is to do whatever we can to preserve as much as possible of the achievements we made. On terrorism, that means to hold the Taliban government accountable for what they promised on terrorism, or not allowing Afghanistan being a platform for launching terrorist attacks against our countries, but also to be ready to strike over the horizon, long distance, and to stay vigilant as NATO allies to follow and monitor closely any attempts to reconstitute international terrorist groups in Afghanistan aiming at us. Then we have to hold them accountable for what they have promised on human rights. I mean, it's not very promising what we have seen so far. It's a tragedy for the Afghan people, especially for women. But we need to put leverage on them, the leverage we have, economic, financial, political, to at least allow humanitarian organizations to come in with development aid, some support, and also to continue to push them on these on values and human rights. And thirdly, we need to continue to get people out. Whatever you think about the evacuation and the withdrawal, it was a huge and impressive achievement to get 124,000 people out of Kabul without military evacuation. The U.S. in lead, but also other allies participating. And NATO also coordinating many of those efforts at the airport. This we will do as allies, continue to be vigilant. The last thing I would say is that the whole perception is Afghanistan is a tragedy for the Afghans. Mm. But it doesn't reduce or weaken the need for Europe and North America to stand together. Mm. So sometimes this is mixed. Also, it's a bad situation in Afghanistan, but it hasn't weakened the message and the need and the relevance of a strong NATO. If anything, just highlighted the importance of what we can achieve together when we stand together in a military mission like Afghanistan.
Are you hopeful, like I am, that the Taliban will be impressed by Western military power enough that they won't want to collaborate with al-Qaeda or any other extremist group in an attack on the West? In other words, that there may still be some deterrence even in the aftermath of this mission failure?
I don't like to use the word hopeful about Taliban. But I think they understand what we have told them, that we have capabilities, we have the capacity to also strike from over the horizon, long distance. NATO allies would do so, especially United States. And we also use the political and economic and financial leverage we have. Of course, it's less leverage than when we had thousands of troops on the ground, but it doesn't mean that we have zero, and we will use that.
So last question, small little question, China. Yeah. And I realize that China is an issue that grew in importance over your tenure. Russia started out with a bang and has stayed there, but China's grown. And it's largely a problem for the European Union, and it's often about investment and economic relationships, not just NATO. But I know that, of course, you've thought about, and NATO's thought about China quite a bit in certain realms. And I just wanted to ask for any update from you on how NATO is looking at China, and maybe even more importantly, what's the next step in that process? What's the next thing NATO has to do with the strategic concept and beyond to think about its relationship with China?
Let me start by saying that the rise of China, that provides great opportunities for all of us, for our economies, for trade, for interacting with them. And the economic rise of China also has helped to lift hundreds of millions of people out of poverty. I think there is it has never happened before in history that so many people have been lifted out of poverty over a short period of time that we have seen in China over the last decades. In my previous life, I worked a lot on child mortality and maternal health, on how to reduce child mortality, and we were able to, also the world was able to achieve a lot, not least because of the enormous gains made in China over the last decades. Then at the same time, the rise of China also poses some serious challenges to NATO allies. And until 2019, NATO did not address that as an alliance at all. We didn't mention China. It was not an issue. We have seen that we have now come a long way in actually agreeing as NATO, as 30 allies, that the rise of China matters for our security. It has an impact on our security. And that applies for all allies. I think that this distinction, to distinguish between China is in the Pacific and then Russia is in Europe, that's wrong. We live in a global security environment. Everything is interconnected. China is close to us in cyberspace. We see them in Africa. We see them in Arctic. We see them investing heavily in our own infrastructure. And actually, one of the first test cases of understanding, of NATO allies understanding the security, potential security impacts of China was 5G. A couple of years ago, most European allies thought that that was only a commercial issue. Who was going to control the 5G network, which is will be basic for almost everything we do. Then, after extensive discussions, bilaterally but also in the NATO framework, NATO allies realized that 5G network matters for our security, for the resilience of societies, and therefore we have seen that that has had some serious consequences for who actually provides the 5G networks across Europe and North America. So that's an example. China has the second largest defense budget in the world. They are investing heavily in new military capabilities, including nuclear, long-range weapon systems. They are building a lot of silos for long-range missiles, and that is to expand their nuclear capabilities. They have the largest navy in the world. Just over the last 5 years, they have deployed more ships than the entire British Navy. So this is a huge and strong military capability, which is expanding year by year. That matters for our security. We don't regard China as an adversary. We don't regard them as an enemy. But we need to relate to all the aspects of the rise of China for our security. We have done that by, for the first time, mentioning China. We did that in the communique or the declaration from the NATO summit in December 2019. That was only one sentence. At the summit in June this year, we had actually some language and some agreed positions. And then I expect that the upcoming new strategic concept for NATO will actually reflect a much more comprehensive and unified position on how to relate to China. Then what we do on technology, on resilience, on investing in new high-end capabilities, we don't put the label China on that, but it matters also when it comes to China. The last thing, and then I promise to end, is that we will continue to engage with China on climate, on arms control. And I spoke just last week with the Chinese foreign minister, and I, in a way, conveyed the same message as I conveyed to you today, that we don't want to isolate China. We also see the big advantages for all of us, the economic strength of China, but there are also some challenges. We need to address them, and we will address them together as NATO.
Fantastic. Well, let's bring in some questions from the audience, and we may get enough right from the room that we don't have time for online questions, but if you want to send in online to events@brookings.edu, we might be able to get one or two of those in as well. Until I see the hook from Dean Hellman, we will take questions. So maybe I'll take two at a time, if that's okay, starting maybe here in the second and third rows. And yes, please.
Is it on? Okay. All right. I'm sorry. Hi, my name is Birgit Musai. I'm a graduate student here at School of Foreign Service. I'm also an Albanian American from Kosovo and deeply disturbed about the situation right now in northern part of Kosovo. And my question was, what is the role of NATO, specifically KFOR, in ensuring that the destabilization and the disturbing of peace doesn't occur again, especially since you mentioned that it should be the decision of a small country to decide whether they want to join NATO. So Kosovo has made attempts to join and is working towards that. But until then, do you think that allowing the Kosovo army in the north of Kosovo or establishing a no-fly zone would be a solution to this, these similar incidents occurring in the future? Thank you so much.
And do you want to just answer that or take one more first?
I take one more, but
great.
Sir, thank you for taking the time to meet with us today. My question is regarding Russia and cyberspace operations. I think most can agree that Russia's been most successful in spreading its malign influence through cyberspace and information operations. NATO's been very successful in countering Russia through conventional means, but how do you see NATO's strategy moving forward to deter and defend against Russian cyberspace and information operations?
So first of all, I would try to be brief because there are many questions. But then, forgive me if I don't cover all the issues you raised. But first on Kosovo. NATO has been in Kosovo for many years. We helped to end the bloodshed there in 1999. And we have an international force, a NATO force there called KFOR. And we helped to stabilize the situation to ensure to secure peace and also protect all communities to provide them with a safe and secure environment, including the Serbs living in Kosovo. Then over the last weeks, we had some tensions at the border crossing points or the crossing points on the administrative borderline or between Kosovo and Serbia. I will not go into all the details, but that was about licensing plate for cars. And then we had some roadblocks and a quite tense and difficult situation with also quite aggressive rhetoric. NATO has helped and supported efforts, which has now led to an agreement to remove the roadblocks and also to remove or withdraw the Kosovo Special Police, which has controlled that area and also the border crossings. Now KFOR will control the border crossings, and we have found a way with some stickers to deal with the licensing plates, and that has at least solved the issue we faced now, reduced the tensions now. More fundamentally, what we need is a political agreement. That's the only way forward. It's not easy, but the alternative is so much worse. So NATO strongly supports the EU-led facilitated dialogue Pristina Belgrade. I spoke with Aleksandar Vučić, the president of Serbia, a couple of weeks ago, recently, and also with Kurti, the prime minister of Kosovo. And we will continue to strongly support these efforts to find a political solution. And KFOR will remain in Kosovo to ensure peace and stability. Then on Russia and cyber, well, a big element, big part of the fundamental adaptation of NATO that has taken place since 2014 is cyber, because there is no way there would be any type of conflict without a significant cyber dimension. So it is not like we will have a conflict and then maybe cyber. Cyber will be part of it, most likely from the beginning and even before we realize that it started. So cyber really matters. And that's also the reason why we have undertaken a huge strengthening of NATO's cyber capabilities, both protecting our own networks but also helping allies to protect and support their networks. We have established cyber as a military domain. Before we had land, air, sea. Now we have land, air, sea, and cyber, and actually also space. We have a cyber command or a center, and then we have also decided that cyber can trigger Article 5, and that's a very important message, meaning that we regard potentially cyber attacks as dangerous, as damaging as kinetic attacks. You can take as many lives, you can really inflict a lot of harm through cyber attacks. Just imagine 9/11 in cyber, and that would be seriously and harmful for many. So we can trigger Article 5, we need a collective defense clause of this alliance, also to a cyber attack. Whether we respond in cyber or in other domains, that's up to us to decide. And the last thing I will say about Sonic Bridge is that we have also developed what is referred to as national cyber effects, but which is actually offensive cyber, that we can use against, we have used them against, NATO allies have used them against ISIS or Daesh to take down their cyber networks as part of the fight against ISIS. So we exercise, we train, we share best practices, so we need to maintain our edge also in the cyber domain to remain the most successful and strongest in history.
Fantastic. Let's take these two in the third row, if I could, please, next to each other. So there are three of you. Maybe we should take all three, if you will.
Okay, thank you. Hi, my name is Jack Gazdia. Thank you for coming to speak with us today. How do you envision the future role of NATO in a world with more of these truly global issues that we see with things like pandemics, climate that you touched on? For example, do you envision changes in how we interpret Article 5 as it relates to how pandemics, climate, arms control, these different issues affect specific NATO member countries? Like, what do you kind of see as the role of that moving forward?
And then, please.
Hi, my name is Megan Skinner, and I'm a sophomore in the School of Foreign Service. And in a similar vein, I would say that COVID-19 is the greatest security threat that we face today because it threatens the citizens not only of all the NATO allies, but of every country in the world. And I was wondering, do you think that members of NATO have sufficiently collaborated to respond to the pandemic? And what more do you think NATO can do to help end the pandemic?
And then we'll take one more if we could, please.
Are you?
Yeah. Yeah, right here. Yep.
Hi, my name's Evelina. I'm a student at the Graduate School of Foreign Service, also from Stockholm, Sweden, fellow Scandinavian. This summer, I listened to your summer speech for the Swedish radio, and was very moved by your discussion or talk on Utøya. Yeah. How would you say that attack and tragic event shaped your leadership for not only Norway, but as a leader of global security as a whole? Thank you. Thank
you. As a first on the pandemic, of course, we face many global threats and challenges, and of course, that also matters for NATO. That doesn't mean that NATO always will be the first responder. For instance, to a pandemic, I don't think NATO is the first responder. We have the health services and so on, who always in that case has to be the first responders. But NATO can play a role, not by invoking Article 5. I don't think the virus will be scared by Article 5. So anyway, so the thing is that sometimes NATO can, Article 5 is not a response, not a answer to the pandemic. But our armed forces and NATO can play a critical and important role, as we did and as we will do in any future pandemic. And of course, we can improve and we can strengthen the way we work together. If you look across the NATO alliance, first of all, we coordinated a lot of efforts by helping to transport critical equipment, medical supplies, personnel. We helped to set up field hospitals and so on. So this was partly organized and facilitated by NATO, but also partly by our national armed forces. They helped to support the civilian health services. So on all these issues, I think what we see now is that the armed forces, they of course can play a role in military conflict, but they also have an important role to play, for instance, in helping to address challenges like the pandemic or more extreme weather and weather events or that poses a risk to all of us. So that's part of what we do and what we exercise and what we plan for. Then on Utøya, first of all, thank you for listening to Sommar I P1, is it?
Yes.
Yeah. That's a Swedish thing, which is where they sometimes invite Norwegians to be part. So I was very honored to be speaking to Swedes. But you asked me a very serious question about Utøya. Because Utøya, or the 22nd of July, that was a terrorist attack on Norway. 77 people were killed, most of them young people participating on a youth camp just outside Oslo. And that's a place where I have been since I was 14 years old every summer, because this is the Social Democratic Party of Norway. And I knew many of the people who were killed there, and I was prime minister, and the perpetrator attacked the camp, but also the government building, and my office was totally destroyed by the bomb. There are many things to say about Utøya, but I think the most important message is that terrorism comes in many forms. And terrorists, they use different guises, or they try to hide behind different religions, different ideologies. But at the end of the day, it's always about the same. It's about intolerance, it's about violence, it's about hatred. And it doesn't matter, in a way, whether they call themselves radical Islamists, or this guy in Norway, he was a Christian right-wing guy, and he killed young Labour Party people because they were too tolerant and open to let Muslims into Norway. They have nothing. All these terrorists, they have more in common with each other than they have with anyone else, because we respect the democratic rules. We respect that differences should be solved in a peaceful manner, and then we can be left or right or green or blue, whatever we are, but we agree on that basic idea that we need strong democratic institutions, and that the way to make political decisions, not by violence. So I think the main message for me is that in Norway it was a right-wing guy that misused the Christian religion. In other places we have seen people misusing other religions. It doesn't matter. It is the same. We have to fight it with everything we have, because we don't want to live in a society where these people are having any impact at all.
I think we have a couple of online questions through Adams, please.
Thank you. Two questions on what you might term disagreements within the NATO family came in from our virtual viewers. The first is if you would comment, please, on the AUKUS deal, on the deal between Australia, UK, and the United States. Are you concerned about the fallout, the disagreement between France and the United States? And relatedly, on France's suggestion that Europe develop its more indigenous capabilities alongside NATO, are you optimistic or worried about this suggestion from France? How do you assess it? And a second question on Turkey and its relationship with Russia, its pursuit of the S-400 missile system. Do you think that this is a concern, and how would you manage it? Thank you.
First, on the AUKUS deal, I understand that France is disappointed. At the same time, NATO allies agree on the bigger picture, that we need to stand together, also working with our Asia-Pacific partners, which includes Australia, Japan, New Zealand, South Korea. And the AUKUS deal is not directed against Europe or NATO. There are two NATO allies, US and UK, that has gone into a deal with Australia. At our NATO summit in June, we actually agreed, all 30 allies, that we should step up and work more closely with the partners in that region of the world. I welcome EU efforts on defense, because NATO has been actually calling on the European Union and EU and NATO allies to do more for many, many years, not least on defense spending. It was a NATO decision in 2014 that triggered the increase in defense spending across Europe and Canada. After years of cutting defense spending, allies have started to increase defense spending, added $260 billion extra. I also think that EU and European NATO allies can do more on providing high-end capabilities, and we welcome and support those efforts. What I don't believe in is any efforts to try to do something outside the NATO framework or compete with or duplicate NATO, because NATO remains the cornerstone, the bedrock for European security, and also for actually North American security. And this is partly about money. 80% of NATO's defense expenditure comes from non-EU NATO allies. So, of course, most of what we invest in defense is not within the EU, it's outside the EU. That's mainly, of course, very much because of the United States, but also other allies. Then it's about geography. Turkey in the south, Norway, Iceland in the north, and in the west, US, Canada, and United Kingdom, if you look at the map, they are important for the protection of and defense of the whole of Europe. And then most importantly and lastly, it's politics. Because any attempt to try to weaken the transatlantic bond by creating alternative structures, conveying the idea that we can go alone, will not only weaken NATO, but it will divide Europe. So we just have to stand together. And if anything, it's even more important that we stand together now, because we are faced with such huge challenges. So we cannot afford to start to divide Europe and North America, or divide Europe. We have to stand together, North America and Europe together, in NATO. So and for me, the AUKUS deal doesn't change that in any way. And also, I've seen someone saying that Afghanistan changed that. Not at all. If anything, Afghanistan just underlines the importance of NATO and Europe working together. Yeah, so that's my answer on that. Then the other one was S-400. Now, I have to admit that that's a difficult issue. It has been discussed again and again between NATO allies, the US and Turkey. I have raised the issue. We have discussed it. I have discussed it in Ankara with President Erdogan and other Turkish leaders. Of course, it is a national prerogative to make decisions on defense procurements. At the same time, what I have stated and what matters for NATO is that those capabilities, this is air defense system, S-400, has to be interoperable with the NATO systems. Has to be possible to integrate in the NATO integrated air and missile defense. That's not the case for S-400. And therefore, we have tried to also find alternative solutions, some Patriot, which is a US system, or something called SAMP-T, which is a French-Italian system. So far, we have not succeeded in that, but we will continue. And we also work. I know that there are some issues and some allies are critical, and that also is expressed openly and in NATO meetings, but Turkey is an important ally. Turkey played a key role in defeating Daesh, bordering Iraq and Syria, and no other ally has received more refugees than Turkey. So Turkey is important. There are some differences, some disagreements, but we need to address them within the NATO framework.
So let's get a couple in the... Yeah, so I see two hands again next to each other, a gentleman in a pink shirt and a woman with gold glasses. Maybe we could take those two. And what might be the last round, or at least the next to last round.
Thank you so much. My name is Cheyenne. I'm a Georgetown graduate student from Singapore. And there was a CSIS talk earlier with a couple of prominent Chinese academics where they talked about desecuritization being necessary for world peace. My question to you is, given the current trend that you described, you know, with 5G leaving the commercial world, you know, also becoming a security issue, what sorts of conditions do you think need to exist in order for desecuritization to actually happen, if at all? Thank you.
Hi, I'm Jack. I'm a first year in the SFS. I just wanted to ask, what role do you think Pacific democracies like New Zealand, Australia, South Korea, and Japan might play in NATO's relationship with China?
Okay.
Please.
So first of all, I strongly believe in NATO working with New Zealand, Australia. They are close partners. They share our democratic values. They share our support to rules-based international order. And this has a value in itself to work with such close partners. At the same time, there is no way to deny that of course, this is something which has become even more important when we see a more assertive China. Especially in that part of the world. We have seen how they have tried to coerce Australia and actually imposed very heavy economic sanctions against them because they didn't behave in the way China wanted them to behave. And that just makes it even more important for us to work together with them. I was in my own country. We, in the Norwegian Nobel Peace Prize Committee, awarded the Peace Prize to a Chinese dissident. And then suddenly China imposed heavy sanctions on Norway because they didn't like that decision. So I don't think we can accept that kind of behavior that they try to coerce other countries because they do things China doesn't like. And that just it makes it more important that we work together, stand together with like-minded democracies as New Zealand and Australia, also in the light of a more coercive or assertive China. Then on the first question, I'm to be honest, I'm a bit confused. What is to de-securitize?
Sure. The way I interpreted it was as the reversal of the trend that you had described earlier, where you talked about how 5G used to be seen as a commercial issue and then now it's become a security issue. I would see that as the reversal of that process. I was just wondering whether you think this is possible at all and what conditions would need to be established for this to be kicked into place. Thank you.
So of course, in theory, it's possible, but the trend is going in the opposite direction. I think that many years ago, it was a kind of a civilian life, and then there was a military life, and it was very easy to distinguish between peace and war. You had either the wars, they took place at battlefields, and the war were declared, an ambassador went to the other country and declared war, and then we almost agreed where to fight, and it was a clear start date and a clear end date, and it was a clear distinction between peace and war and civilian and military sector. Now, that line is much more blurred. First of all, you know, in hybrid, in cyber, and so on, it's a much more blurred line between peace and war, aggressive actions or peaceful interaction. So the trend is going in the opposite direction, and I regret that. But that's the reality. That with more hybrid and cyber threats and attacks. Bigger parts of the whole society is involved also in different kinds of conflicts and competition, state-to-state rivalry. I think the long run, the only way to prevent this from happening is partly, of course, some regulations and agreements, for instance, how to behave in cyberspace. But at the end of the day, this is about trust and creating a more peaceful society, a global society. And then perhaps we can also de-securitize some of these civilian capabilities and areas where we see state-to-state competition today.
Fantastic questions and answers. Dean, over to you for the final thoughts. With apologies, we couldn't get more of you in, but thanks.
Well, our hour has gone by very quickly. You started, Secretary General, by saying that you thought you might prepare for an academic life. And if I may say so, the clarity of your remarks, the cogency, you would have made a very good professor. And indeed, when you step down as Secretary General, you're always welcome here at the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. Let me thank again our co-sponsors on this, Brookings and Mike O'Hanlon. It's great to have you here and great to partner with you on this event, and we hope to partner more. Let me thank again the students for your enthusiastic engagement. Sorry for those we had to turn away from our COVID-related restricted space, but hopefully you were able to join online, and thank you all of our Facebook Live participants. Thank you, enjoy the rest of the day, and thank you for joining us.